Some who don't have a lobbyist to protect their economic interests may have to appeal directly to the public. They are cyber begging, as it's called. Thousands ask for money on the website Craigslist. NPR's Pam Fessler has been scanning other sites like Begslist, Cyberbeg, and DonateMoneyToMe.com.
The appeals are heart-wrenching. A single mom with no money to pay her bills, an unemployed construction worker about to lose his house, and of course lots of families who can't afford gifts for Christmas. Certainly some of these appeals are scams, but many appear to be legitimate pleas for help.
I'm a partially disabled single father with two young sons, 7 and 8. They deserve to get a few nice toys and things for Christmas. They're really good kids. I don't make enough money to be able to buy them anything.
Michael Arthur of Frederick, Maryland, says he debated for weeks before placing this ad on Craigslist. He works at a local veterinarian's office, despite his back problems. But he's had a hard time making ends meet, so he decided it was worth a shot.
If anyone out there could possibly help me obtain a few toys for my children, please let me know. I hate to beg, but I will for my children.
Arthur says the bad economy forced him to swallow his pride.
I mean, it's kind of embarrassing to have to do something like this, but I figured maybe there'd be somebody out there that would be willing to, you know, help out for Christmas, you know, just a couple of toys or something.
But so far, no luck. He says three people responded, but only one seemed really interested in helping. And Arthur didn't hear back after he sent a detailed list with his son's clothing sizes and what they might want.
I'm not trying to be greedy at all. No way, no how.
That's Teresa Burton of Durham, North Carolina. Her Craigslist ad was entitled, Adopt a Family for Christmas. She's an unemployed single mother of three. She says she gets some public aid, but not enough for gifts.
It's just, I would like to have my kids to have a decent Christmas this year.
But again, no response. She and others say that could be because there are so many people looking for help. Many say they've tried local charities, but they too are overwhelmed with requests. Still, like others I spoke to, Burton says she'd never think about going out on the street to beg. Why is this different, would you say?
I think it's a little bit more discreet. I don't know, to me it might be a little bit more embarrassing actually going out on the street, you know, begging for somebody to help me for something.
Doing it online is a little bit more private.
Rex Campos-Agrado is the founder of Begslist, a free site devoted to online begging. He says he gets about 20 posts a day, even more around the holidays. Campos-Agrado created the site a few years ago when his own internet business went under and he was out of work. And he had a bad experience begging online. Some sites charged him money, which he says didn't make sense, since that's what he needed.
I thought it should be a free thing. If people on the street are begging, they're not asked to pay a fee to beg on the street.
And indeed, some sites charge up to $45 a month. DonateMoneyToMe.com says that's so it can provide better services, including advice on how to enhance an online appeal by using phrases such as, with your help we can go on, and your generosity can give a new lease on life. Of course, the big question hanging over all this is how much of it's real. Campos-Agrado says his site, like others, warns donors and beggars alike about possible fraud.
If you see a posting that's from overseas with a UK address and the story that they're telling is in broken English and it's very hard to understand, a lot of times it's made by a scammer.
He also suggests that people use safeguards such as PayPal instead of checks or money orders. Craigslist has similar advice and says users should only deal with those who they can meet in person in a public place. Which is advice that Michelle Santos of Richmond, Virginia, says she's taken to heart. She posted an ad last month asking for toys and clothes, which she plans to give to the needy.
I mean, it is Christmas time. A lot of people do try to scam one another. But honestly, you run across families that are in true, true need.
She says she knows because she visits them first. Her ad attracted some donations, but she also got 900 emails from people looking for help. She hopes to help about 100. Pam Fessler, NPR News.
And the road ahead in Iraq is also strewn with challenges. We got another reminder yesterday when a series of bombs in Baghdad killed more than 120 people. Along with bringing the violence under control, the country must also rebuild its economy. Iraq still depends heavily on oil revenue. Most jobs still come from the government and not the private sector. And there, in the private sector, business people complain of so much red tape, it's throttling efforts to start new businesses. NPR's Corey Flintoff begins his story on the floor of the stock exchange.
This is the nerve center of capitalism in Baghdad, the Iraqi Stock Exchange. At 11 o'clock in the morning, the trading floor is packed with men watching the progress of their shares on widescreen TVs. The director of the exchange, Taha Abdusalam, is proud of his operation. It's still small, with just over 70 companies traded on volume worth about $2 million a day. But that's a big leap from the first session in 2004, when around $150,000 changed hands and prices were scrawled on the board by hand. Abdusalam wants to keep up that growth, but he's got a problem. It's very hard to bring new businesses onto the exchange because very few are being formed. He says one major problem is unclear and unnecessarily complex regulation.
How can you invite people to invest in your country? By preparing them very clear regulation.
Right now, that regulation is anything but clear.
To start a new business takes 11 procedures at 11 different ministries.
That's Frank Gunter, a professor of economics at Lehigh University.
It requires, on average, if you know what you're doing, if you have good legal advice, it takes 77 days, and it costs about $2,800.
Gunter studied Iraq's business climate as the senior civilian economic advisor to the U.S. military in Iraq from 2008 to 2009. He cites a recent study by the World Bank that measures the cost and ease of starting a business in 183 countries. Iraq scored close to the bottom at 153. Gunter argues that support for private business is a national security issue for Iraq. Here's why. The Iraqi government now provides jobs, either directly or indirectly, for about 50% of the workforce. That was at least temporarily affordable when Iraq's revenues were fattened by high oil prices. Now, with prices down, Gunter says the situation will get worse because each year, about 250,000 young Iraqis enter the job market.
If they don't find jobs, then these young Iraqis, mostly men, mostly young, mostly uneducated, becomes a recruiting pool for the gangs, the criminal gangs, for the insurgency, for the militias that work for the religious and the political groups.
Gunter says Iraq's business climate contributes to its other major problem, corruption. In a recent survey by Transparency International, Iraq ranked fifth from the bottom, making it one of the most corrupt countries in the world.
It's because the regulatory environment is so hostile, it forces businesses to be corrupt to survive. Some of the survey data we did in Iraq shows that many small businesses pay 20 or 40% of all their cost is in bribes.
Gunter says one step in the right direction would be for Iraq to adopt a commercial code more like those of Saudi Arabia or Kuwait, which rank in the top third of business-friendly countries. Iraq's planning minister, Dr. Ali Baban, says he's not ready to accept Professor Gunter's diagnosis that Iraq's economy is on the brink of collapse. But he admits the situation is dire. Baban says that unless the government hurries to support the productive sectors, industry and agriculture, it will be in a situation that, in his words, no one will envy. Gunter says he's not without hope. His time in Iraq has taught him respect for the country's entrepreneurial tradition.
I argue that anybody who can survive as a small businessman in the underground economy in Baghdad is the ultimate entrepreneur.
Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Baghdad.
With many small businesses cutting expenses to the bone this past year just to get by, worker morale has taken a beating. As part of our ongoing series on small businesses, Blake Farmer of member station WPLN visited a machine shop in Clarksville, Tennessee, where employees are keeping their chins up and hoping more work will come their way.
Ron Smithfield has been forced to make a string of painful announcements this year as business has dropped off more than 35%. Typically, he gathers everyone in the company break room, where there's a folding table, a dozen chairs, and a giant notepad with the number 32 in red permanent marker.
Schedule, 32 hours.
That was the announcement right there?
Yeah.
Smithfield instituted a four-day work week, sometimes less. Other pages explain why the company suspended its retirement program and how health benefits have been reduced. Smithfield cut his own pay by 20%.
We said, you know, we can't expect other people to take a cut if we don't take a substantial cut, and we have done that.
But it wasn't enough, and Smithfield had to lay off six employees this year.
We're like one big family, and so that was a tough decision, probably delayed longer than it should have been, but it was necessary.
My name is Norma Previance. I have been here for 15 years. I am now a tooling buyer and a safety coordinator and customer service.
With so many cutbacks, the 17 remaining employees are wearing a few more hats. Previance takes orders between running a punch press. She says she's happy to multitask because that makes her harder to replace.
My husband and I both work here. So, I mean, when layoffs come around, you know, it can hit us from either direction. This is our entire family income is at this company.
So the reduction in hours hit the Previance home twice as hard. That's why they planted a new vegetable garden and found other ways to feed the family.
And my husband hunts for all of our meat, so we don't have that in our grocery bill. We've bought a grinder so that we can grind our deer meat on our own. So, you know, I'm not going to go hungry.
While preparing for the worst, Previance says they're thankful to be taking home two paychecks, even if they are considerably smaller. Still, she's listening for the volume to pick up on the shop floor. In a hazy room, 22-year employee Michael Davenport turns raw metal into shiny nuts and bolts. Of the dozen screw machines, only one is operating today, dropping specialized fasteners into a metal pan.
I'm the only one that runs these machines now, but at one time we had like two, three or four people running them all at once.
Smithfield's biggest customer makes parts for Caterpillar tractors. That account has taken a direct hit by the sudden drop in U.S. construction. Davenport says he knows exactly how slow business is when he grabs his orders for the day.
I have a notebook that I keep all my work in, and it's a lot of times it was pretty full, and now it's just one or two, you know. That bothers you sometimes when you're afraid you're going to go to that notebook, it's going to be empty.
What were your orders like this morning when you picked up your book?
I've got two. Hopefully by the first of the week there'll be some more come in.
Orders have picked up slightly, and the company's called back two laid-off workers. There's also new opportunity to supply a solar manufacturer building a plant nearby. As other metal workers go out of business, Davenport says Smithfield Manufacturing just has to hold on.
And when things pick back up, there's going to be a lot less competition for what we do.
For Davenport, that optimism makes the recession's hardships bearable. For NPR News, I'm Blake Farmer in Nashville.
And you'll find more in our series, Navigating the Recession, at NPR.org. You'll also find an interactive map that shows foreclosures, income, and jobless rates by the county.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Today, the Obama administration extended the controversial Troubled Asset Relief Program, known as TARP. In a letter to Congress, Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner said TARP would operate through early October of next year. That extension came as TARP received a report card from the panel that Congress appointed to oversee it. NPR's John Itzde has both stories.
The report from the Congressional Oversight Panel was really an assessment of the TARP's performance during its first year. And despite the controversy surrounding the program, panel member Richard Nieman said that TARP had succeeded in its basic mission.
The report clearly gives credit to TARP for having achieved the primary objective of restoring general financial stability and liquidity in the financial system.
But Nieman, who is also New York State's superintendent of banks, said the $700 billion program faced challenges in achieving its other goals.
And those revolve around the increasing foreclosures that are facing our country, as well as issues around credit availability, particularly for small businesses.
Over the past year, most TARP resources have gone to shore up large Wall Street banks and financial institutions. But the injections of capital have not succeeded in providing enough credit for many small businesses to create jobs. In his letter notifying Congress of the program's extension, Secretary Geithner said that in the coming year, the TARP program would focus on providing lending to small businesses, along with additional efforts to head off foreclosures. Former IMF chief economist Simon Johnson is skeptical.
Well, I think that won't make much difference, to be honest, unfortunately. That refocusing is mostly for political reasons.
Johnson, now an MIT professor, says only the recovery of the economy will make a significant difference in small business job creation and a reduction in mortgage foreclosures. Johnson says the TARP program needed to be extended because the financial system still faces challenges from shaky credit card and mortgage financing. But he said the terms for recipients of aid should be tougher in the future.
Much tougher, much more favorable to the taxpayer, and less favorable to the bankers who make the big bad mistakes.
Secretary Geithner suggested in his letter that in the end, the TARP program would cost taxpayers around $140 billion. Bank of America said today it has completed repayment of the $45 billion it owed the TARP. John Itzty, NPR News, Washington.